So today's speaker is Professor Alex Berg from Weizmann Institute of Science. This is the place I always call Weizmann Institute of Science. There are a lot of wise men there. Alex got his PhD at Stanford, and then he was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard. Then he went back to Weizmann, and he was a faculty member there. I think the University of Chicago could hold on him for brief period of time, but then I think he went back. So he has done a lot of interesting work. His research interest is very broad. He worked on things like topological phase of matter, superconductivity, quantum criticality, and lots of interesting work. So Eric is going to tell us about new physics in Moore flat bands. Please go ahead, Eric.
Right. Thank you very much. It's a very nice opportunity to speak in this forum. Sorry, I couldn't visit in person. I don't know what format you had in mind in terms of questions. I suggest that if you have questions, you should just go ahead and ask. So it's always hard to these Zoom meetings are hard enough as they are. So I suggest you just ask questions whenever they arise. But I'll try to pause somewhere along the way and see if there are questions. Started with having way too much material for this talk, but Zoom meetings are tough, so I decided to try to lighten up. So I'm going to tell you about two projects that are motivated by this new emerging field of more rare materials, and this is work I've done with Johannes Hoffmann, Eyal Goldfeld, who are my postdocs at Weizmann, with the Bungian at Cornell, and with Mark from Copenhagen. So just to set the stage, so I'd like to start with this nice quote from Bhaskaran. So these new more rare systems, which I'm sure you all heard about, are kind of a new paradigm for a strongly correlated system. And I think that's what makes them interesting. This field started really 10 years ago, when it was predicted that twisted bilayer graphene can be tuned to a very special twist angle between two graphene sheets, and you get extremely flat bands, and therefore there should be some interesting correlation effects. And a couple of years ago, this was actually implemented in the lab, and it was found that the system indeed, when tuned to the magic angle, indeed exhibits all sorts of interesting correlated phenomena, like very correlated insulators and superconductivity. And let me just stress that by now, this is not the only system that shows similar physics. So twisted bilayer graphene was the first, but now there's also bilayer on bilayer, so two non-twisted graphene bilayers that have a relative twist to each other. There's a system of trilayer graphene with a perpendicular electric field that also has some interesting correlated phases. There are now twisted transition metal dicalcogenides also show some of these phenomena. So it's really a whole family of new kinds of systems. And what's sort of interesting about the system? What is the reason I think that people are so excited? So I think these systems really offer a new type of playground for strongly correlated many-body quantum physics that is not easily available in any of the existing systems, like bulk materials, for instance. So the first property that these systems have is that they have a vastly tunable ratio of the interaction strength and the bandwidth. That's something that's usually very hard to control. Maybe in cold atoms you can do it, but this is the first time that you can do it to such a degree in electronic systems, as far as I know. They have some new degrees of freedom. So for instance, many of these systems have a valley degeneracy in addition to spin degeneracy, so that opens up new possibilities. There's an interesting interplay between band topology, superconductivity, and strong correlations. it turns out that in some of these systems, the bands are kind of naturally topological or almost topological, and that inevitably enters the game and has intertwines with the superconducting state and with the correlated insulating states. And finally, there are new probes that are easy in these systems, being 2D systems, and are hard in bulk materials. It often happens that it's sort of complementary. The things that are easy in bulk materials are hard here because it's 2D. So there's kind of any bulk probe is difficult. But there are new probes, like scanning probes, for instance, electronic compressibility is another example of things that are actually much more easy to access in these systems that are hard to access in bulk strongly correlated materials. So so it's really a fascinating playground. I think we're just in the beginning, and there's a lot to learn. It's also, as usual with strongly correlated quantum systems, it's a somewhat the humbling experience. Often you realize that it's very hard to make predictions about strongly correlated materials. But with that caveat in mind, nevertheless, I'm going to present here two theoretical projects that are inspired by this kind of new emerging physics of correlated electrons in flat Moiré bands. None of them is sort of as of yet directly related to the experiments, but hopefully, hopefully in the future there would be some contact. Okay, so the first project I'm going to tell you about is sort of very generally on superconductivity in flat bands, and this is work done with Johannes and with Gbanjan, just in press in PRB. The question I'd like to ask is the following. So we have these kind of systems and they have this vastly tunable ratio of the bandwidth W to the interaction strength U. Okay, and clearly when we reduce this ratio, decrease the bandwidth, the correlations are going to be stronger and stronger. In particular, we can ask what happens to superconductivity as we go through this process. So for instance, let's try to go to the extreme limit. So let's try to make the system as correlated as possible. So in particular, we can take the bandwidth, the limit of the bandwidth going to zero, okay, keeping the interaction fixed. And then we can ask what happens to superconductivity in this limit. Okay, and this is an old paradigm that we've been used to. So there are two effects that limit superconductivity in general. One of them is the pairing scale, and the other one is the phase ordering scale. Okay, so in order to have superconductivity, you need to have both a formation of Cooper pairs, but also the phase of these Cooper pairs has to become coherent. Otherwise, it's not a superconductor. Okay, and what you very generally, on general grounds, what you might expect is that in the limit where the bandwidth, the ratio of the bandwidth to the interaction goes to zero, maybe Cooper pairs can form if you have attractive interactions, but the phase ordering scale would also go to zero. Okay, and this is what happens in a simple toy model. For instance, the negative U Hubbard model. This is precisely what happens. So this is a sketch of TC as a function of the attractive interaction, a local attractive interaction U in the negative U Hubbard model. This is the bandwidth W. Okay, and if U is much smaller than W, we get the usual BCS behavior. So TC is goes to zero exponentially in the limit U goes to zero. But as we crank up U more and more, TC would reach a maximum, basically when U is of order W. And then when U is larger than W, TC would start decreasing. In particular, it would decrease in this particular way, like W squared over U. And this is a result of the fact that as U becomes larger than the bandwidth, the limiting factor for TC is the phase ordering scale. Okay, and that actually scales in this way. Okay, and in fact, it turns out that the actual value of the maximum TC, which is attainable in the negative U Hubbard model, is known. So because of the fact that it occurs when U is of order W, it has to be of order W. That's the only energy scale that's left in the problem after you optimize TC. And it turns out to be W times this relatively small number. Okay, so this is sort of the maximum TC you can get in the proper units. in the negative U hybrid model. So that makes you think, is that all there is to it? It looks like going to the limit of extremely flat bands is always going to be bad for superconductivity. And that's the question I'd like to ask. So it was proposed, okay, actually quite a while ago by Volovic, that that doesn't have to be the case. Okay, so what he argued is that if you go to the limit of extremely flat bands, what you might get, okay, so clearly BCS theory doesn't hold. Nevertheless, TC doesn't have to go to zero. The only energy scale in the problem that's left then is the interaction scale. So what might happen is that the phase ordering scale itself would scale like the interaction. Okay, and therefore also TC would scale like the interaction strength. Okay, so this is a limit of an extremely strongly correlated system, but it would also mean that it's an extremely, it's sort of the best superconductor you can have, extremely non-BCS dependence of TC on the interaction strength. And if you think about it, what prevents this from happening in the negative U Hubbard model, and what's the necessary condition for this to happen? So the necessary condition is the following. So we're dealing with electrons in some band, and we need to ask, what is the character of the wave functions of this band? Okay, so we want to project the electron wave functions to this active band. And as long as these wave functions are not localized on individual sites, when we project the interaction, we can get actually some finite phase ordering scale. Okay, so the idea is the following. In the negative U Hubbard model, for instance, the Wannier functions that span the band, okay, so there's only one band in that model, the Wannier functions that span that band are completely localized on sites. So if you turn on the, you turn off the hopping, the hopping, that means you take the bandwidth going to zero, you form Cooper pairs, but these Cooper pairs are completely localized. On the other hand, if we consider the different model where the Wannier functions spanning the band are more delocalized, then even if the kinetic energy or the bandwidth is zero, the interaction itself would induce hopping of the Cooper pair. And that's because of the fact that the interaction would have matrix elements between Wannier functions that are not localized on the site. So that's the basic idea. Okay, and we know of situations where the Wannier functions of a single band are necessarily actually not localizable. In fact, there's no possible choice of Wannier functions which are exponentially localized, and that's in the case of a topological band. Okay, so Volovic sort of had this discussion in a very general term, but later people realized that having topological bands is actually a good direction. It's actually a good starting point in seeking superconductivity in an extremely flat band. Okay, so that's the idea, that if you can find such a superconductor, then TC would scale linearly with the interaction strength. Okay, so this is what TC as a function of interaction strength for a fixed and small bandwidth might look like. Okay, so when the interaction strength is much smaller than the bandwidth, TC would follow the BCS formula. It would be suppressed exponentially. But once the interaction strength exceeds the bandwidth, what you expect is that rather than reaching a maximum and starts decreasing, TC would just keep going linearly with interaction strength. You can ask how far does it go? Of course, it won't go indefinitely. Okay, eventually it would start being suppressed. There are other energy scales in the problem. For instance, the band gap to the next band in the problem. But as long as the interaction strength is smaller than that, TC would just keep increasing linearly. Okay, but of course, this is by no means obvious that this is what would happen. Okay, it's a strongly correlated problem. So by definition, the interaction strength is bigger than all the other energy scales in this regime. So you can ask, even if TC is possible in principle, what about other competing states? Instead of forming a superconductor, does the system phase separate? Does it form some sort of other type of ordered state, like a charge density wave? Okay, or maybe a more exotic state? That's by no means obvious a priori. So the these works dealt with the system using mean field theory. It's not strictly speaking BCS mean field theory, because it's not the BCS instability. It's not the Cooper's instability, but nevertheless, within mean field, you definitely can get superconducting solutions. But can we find an example where we can study this interplay between superconductivity and other competing states?
So there is a question from Legion Zhu.
Yeah.
Thanks. So I just want to understand this mechanism better. Suppose we don't have a topological band, but just a trivial band. But however, yes. somehow the one-way functions are very extended.
Yes.
Should I also expect this phenomena of TC being proportional to U?
Yes. Yeah. That's a very good question. So this is actually something we're looking at a little bit now. The results I'm going to present here in a moment are for a topological band specifically. That's sort of a way to guarantee that the way the one-year functions projected to the band, as you know very well, cannot be localized. But the reverse is sort of not true. You can have a trivial band where the wave functions are exponentially localized, but they're not tightly localized in the site. That's actually sufficient to get TC. We now have an example like that, where we can get this type of superconductivity with similar character, even when the band is trivial. It's enough just to have some spread of the one-year functions. But having a topological band helps. Okay, it's more of a quantitative effect, but it definitely helps because the wave functions are more delocalized. In particular, they cannot be localized in any limit, instead of as long as it's a topological band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. I guess this is relevant because in the real system, the topology is often protected by some symmetries.
Yes. Right.
Then right. It becomes relevant.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions before I go on? Right. Okay. So we wanted to see how all this plays out in a particular model, and let me just flash our results quickly. Okay. So the model we chose is a negative U Hubbard model. In a topological band, so we design a band structure such that there are two bands with Chern numbers plus and minus. To preserve time reversal symmetry, we have two spin flavors, and the hopping for spin down is the complex conjugate of the hopping for spin up, such that the model has time reversal symmetry. You can think about this as a model with strong spin orbit coupling. Okay, so it's a square lattice with two sites per unit cell, so two bands. And it turns out from this paper by Titus and friends that you can design these bands with the first and second neighbor hopping to have quite flat bands. Okay, so this is the band structure for some optimal choice of parameters. The ratio between the band gap and the width of each one of these two bands is about 1 to 5. Okay, so these bands can be made relatively flat, and again, both of these bands are Chern bands. This one has, say, Chern number +1 for spin up and -1 for spin down, and this one vice versa. Okay, so that's basically the model. Now it turns out that by adding a further neighbor hopping, we really wanted to see force the issue. So we wanted to see what happens as this band becomes extremely flat. By adding a further neighbor hopping, you can make the lower band much, much flatter at the expense of making the upper band more dispersive. So this ratio between the band gap and the band width can be made over 100. Okay, so this band is really for our practical purposes almost completely flat. Okay, yes.
So up and down means upper band and lower band. They don't mean spin. Is that right? Or
no. So up and down means spin. There are two sites per unit cell. The the hopping is modulated from one unit cell.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. Yeah, right, right, right. Okay, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a bundle of spinful electrons.
Okay.
And,
okay.
The interaction is just on site of the square lattice.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Right. Okay. So we fix one of these parameter choices. So we're going to have a more dispersive band and a more flat band. And we're going to study the problem as a function of U of the attractive interaction strength. Okay, and our tool to do this would be quantum Monte Carlo. Okay, so this problem doesn't suffer from the sign problem. So that means that we can essentially reliably solve this problem on a sufficiently large system, take the thermodynamic and just read off the results. Okay, so we're going to take sort of a numerical experiment approach to this problem. I'm just going to show you some of these things, some of the things that this model does. Okay, so first of all, here's TC. So we can measure directly the superfluid density in this model as a function of the interaction strength for these two values of the bandwidth. Okay, so the band gap is always 4 units of the nearest neighbor hopping T. And this is TC, basically the Cossolis Tauless transition temperature as a function of U. Okay, and the first thing you notice is that for the case of the extremely flat band, from interaction strength equals 0 up to this interaction strength, which is about half the band gap, it's pretty much a straight line. Okay, so this is TC proportional to U. This means that we are looking at what we think we are looking at. Okay, this is really a superconductivity in this flat band limit, where the only relevant energy scale essentially is the interaction strength. Okay, and you see what happens when you turn on the bandwidth on. Okay, so when the bandwidth becomes bigger, TC goes up. This implies that TC was limited by the phase ordering, and having a larger bandwidth helps it. It's a larger effect at weak coupling, and these two curves sort of tend to converge to each other at stronger coupling because the bandwidth is small relative to the interaction strength. Okay, so TC indeed occurs. Now we can ask once we found the superconducting state, we can ask other questions. For instance, what's the nature of the normal state if the temperature is larger than TC? What's the normal state? So we started from completely flat bands, but maybe there's a dispersion that is induced by the interactions themselves, and maybe the normal state forms some kind of Fermi liquid state. We looked at properties of the non-superconducting state. Okay, so this is now as a function of temperature, and what we're looking at is the spin susceptibility. Okay, so it turns out that this is a singlet or S-wave superconductor. So the spin susceptibility, which is this, look at these red curves, that's suppressed to 0 at low temperature, but the suppression onsets, if you look at this dashed red curve. That's the curve for the case of the more flat band. There's a very broad maximum, and it starts turning down quite a bit above TC, which is this dashed arrow over here. Okay, so there's a big separation in the flat band limit between the onset of what seems to be a spin gap and TC. So it looks like the physics here is the physics of preformed pairs. You start forming Couplier pairs way above TC, and TC is where they attain phase coherence. Okay, and this separation between the position of the gap in the spin susceptibility and TC becomes smaller when you go to the broader band, which is kind of what you expect. Okay, so this is the solid red curve is the spin susceptibility for the case of the broader band. Okay, and these green curves are actually the orbital magnetic susceptibility. We wanted to probe superconducting fluctuations in another way. So this is the diamagnetic orbital susceptibility. And you see that it starts turning down quite a bit above TC again. Okay, so this is a sign that there's a very broad regime in the normal state where there's a strong superconducting fluctuations that are not condensed yet. Okay, so this is our picture for the normal state. And another thing we were looking for is competing orders or competing states. So it turns out that the system is a superconductor, okay? Definitely within the model I've shown you, the system is a superconductor, but it actually is also on the verge of phase separation. This is something we were actually surprised to see at first, and now I think we understand it. So let me tell you a little bit about that. So this is a plot of the inverse susceptibilities of charge and superconductivity, okay? So the chi delta is the pairing susceptibility of this model, and chi n is the charge susceptibility. And what's plotted here is the inverse of these two susceptibilities as a function of temperature. Okay, and triangles are the pairing susceptibility, the circles are the charge susceptibility. Focus on these, for instance, of these solid curves, that's the case of the broader band. So you see that both of these curves sort of go down together, which means that both susceptibilities actually are enhanced as you lower the temperature together. Okay, now the triangles are always lower, which means that the superconductive susceptibility is higher, and indeed that wins. So when this goes to zero, this is the inverse susceptibility. So the susceptibility diverges. So this means this is TC. You see that before you hit TC, the charge susceptibility, which means the tendency of the system to phase separate, it keeps being enhanced, and eventually it saturates when the system becomes a superconductor. Okay, but when you go to the more flat band, which is the dashed curves, you see that this effect becomes more dramatic. The two curves almost converge, and it's kind of hard to see. You need to really zoom in. Eventually, the superconductivity wins, but it wins really by a small margin. Okay, so the system is sort of almost phase separated, and eventually it becomes a superconductor. Now we can encourage this tendency to phase separation, okay, by turning on a weak nearest neighbor attraction, okay, which is about 10% of the on-site attraction U. And it turns out that that's actually sufficient to tilt the balance. Okay, so if you turn on this small nearest neighbor attractive interaction, the system actually is not a superconductor. It actually phase separates before becoming a superconductor. Okay, so this is now the same quantities. The circles are the inverse charge susceptibility, and you see that that actually hits zero, meaning that the system phase separates when the superconducting susceptibility is still finite, and then it becomes hard to do the calculation below the phase separation transition. Okay, so indeed, the fact that the system is strongly correlated, it does have a strong manifestation. There is this very close competition between superconductivity and another state. In this case, it's a phase separation. Now, when we were first saw this, we were very surprised, but now I think we understand it. Okay, so it turns out that there's a nice argument. For a class of models with flat bands, of which this model belongs, it turns out that in the limit where the band is completely flat, and when the interaction is much smaller than the band gap, but much bigger than any other energy scale in the problem, there is an approximate SU2 symmetry that relates the charge susceptibility and the superconducting susceptibility. Okay, so in this ideal limit, if we can really take the bandwidth to zero, and then take the on-site Q to be much smaller than the gap to the other band, then we would actually have a complete degeneracy between the superconducting and the charge susceptibilities. Okay, so these would become components of an SU2 symmetric order parameter, and then actually TC would be exactly zero because of this symmetry. Okay, the symmetry is weakly broken, both because of the fact that the band has a slight bandwidth, and because of the fact that U is finite, not zero, and the temperature is finite. Okay, all these effects break the symmetry weakly, and we believe that's why in the Baer Hubbard model TC, superconductivity eventually wins, and there's a finite TC, but the competition is very close. Okay, so
this can I ask is, a question. What yes. filling are you at in all this?
So we varied the filling. These results are at half filling when the lower band is half filled, Okay, but the results are not very strongly dependent on filling. So TC has sort of a broad maximum near half filling of the lower band.
But this symmetry that you're talking about is special property at half filling.
So this symmetry is sort of exact at half filling. If you go away from half filling of the flat band, that's essentially like applying a Zeeman field to a ferromagnet that breaks that symmetry in the direction that favors charge phase separation.
So there's also another symmetry, which is symmetry to charge density wave at half filling.
Right. So it turns out that this model, that's the symmetry that you would get in the nearest neighbor, ordinary negative U Hubbard model.
Due to topology.
Yeah. This symmetry is not here. Okay. Yeah. Right. Right. This is indeed what we expected. Sort of our intuition came from that. We expected competition with the charge density wave, but it turns out you don't get that here. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about this problem, as we have so far. And before I move on, let me just pause and ask if there are any other questions.
Jay, can I have a quick question?
Yeah.
What about the coherence length? Can you say anything about those for the?
So it's a good question. We didn't come up with a very good way to probe for it. I would guess it's kind of very short, but we would need to think how to probe it. Yeah, it's a good question.
I have a question.
One would guess that it's sort of lattice spacing, just because there's no other length scale of the problem. Mm-hmm. It's would sort of be characteristic of the typical sort of minimum size of a wave packet projected to the lowest band. Okay, which is of the order of the lattice spacing. It's not necessarily one lattice spacing, but it's kind of short. Yeah, but it's
a question. From Senka.
I think this is a very nice calculation. I think the Moray system actually challenged theories about what is the right description and how would that partially filled topological band affect interaction. So I wonder if you tuned your band structure to a non-topological but keep everything else the same, like a filling interaction
bandwidth. Yeah.
Do you see the same?
Yeah. That we're working on that now. Yeah. We have some results. We have a model where you can tune more easily while keeping the band completely flat. We can tune more easily between topological and non-topological, and you can tune the size of the sort of minimum size of the 1E functions. And but no concrete results yet.
Okay. That's too up here.
Question. You probably said it, but I didn't quite catch it. How did you do these calculations?
These are done using quantum Monte Carlo. So this model, due to the fact that it has only attractive interactions, doesn't suffer from the sign problem.
Right. And how large are the systems?
So you can go to about 20 by 20 lattices. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty convinced that all the quantities I'm showing have very, very small finite size dependence at these sizes.
And presumably periodic boundary conditions.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
And sorry, a quick thing. So you probably told the occupation factor.
Right. So these calculations are for a half filled lower band. But we changed that a little bit, and the results are not dramatically different. So the TC varies as a function of density. It sort of has a very broad maximum near half filling of the lower band. And then
it goes to feel the band, or does it do anything funny when you feel
TC goes to zero, of course. Okay. Yeah. Yes. So when you start filling the band, TC starts decreasing towards zero.
Thanks.
Hi, Iris. I have a very sort of very general big picture question about this. So this goes back to the days of Vic Emery, right? And Vic explained to me a long, long, long time ago that when you just feed the system subjective interactions, you're bound to find phase separation, and only under very special conditions, right, you can expect anything special in a paired channel. Right? So when you make your bands completely flat,
yes,
it's so that you're basically touching on this old Vic Emery sentiment that you know, the big deal should really be phase separation, can be lucky when you find any pairing.
Yeah, so in some sense, I totally agree with the sentiment. It's kind of, in this situation, it's surprising to find anything which is not phase separation, right? So,
You're sort of doing the pairing for you, right? Because you have topological pairs.
Yeah. So this is very analogous to, you know, to a problem of electrons in a Landau level. So there are repulsive interactions, but in some sense there's a lot of similarity. So you start from a density interaction and project it to a band that has a non-trivial structure of the wave function. So you can get very non-trivial physics, which is coming from this projection. So I think that's what's really responsible for this here.
Okay. Another question, Erez.
Yeah.
There is almost a theorem in ordinary, meaning ordinary bands, that when you calculate the T matrix, U is never much larger than W. The T matrix is never much larger than W, provided you are not, unless you are at special fillings in a band.
Yes.
With these non-localizable Wannier functions,
I think you can violate.
Does one escape that theorem?
I think so. Yeah, I think if you calculate right, I mean, so it's been done. There's a paper that does this. Basically solve the two-body problem in this kind of churn band, flat churn band, by Torma et al. And indeed, they find that the T matrix is of the order of U, even though the band is flat. Yeah, so I think you
that term is still valid, but in superconductivity, you seem to be escaping that.
Yes.
That's...
I think this the theorem assumes something about... the structure of the interaction. There's a somewhat related theorem. It's kind of interesting, the background for this project. So there was a proposed bound on the superfluid density, which is basically coming from the optical sum rule. So the claim was that you can't get the superfluid density to be bigger than of order EF. Just because of the optical sum rule, and that would tell you that TC can never in 2D, at least TC can never be much bigger than the bandwidth, and this is also apparently violated by these kind of systems. Okay, so I think it's a somewhat related story. The issue is that when you project the current operator onto these bands that have a very non-trivial structure, the current actually picks a term that comes from the interaction itself. I see that Mohit is here.
Yeah, it is. Actually, I think you're misquoting the bound, because actually all of these are multi-band systems, and the multi-band bound is perfectly okay.
I see.
What you said was a single band bound, and you can't use a single band bound for a system such as yours.
Yeah. So I think we...
And actually in unpublished work, we have done the bound after projection, and we get bounds which are off order U.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Appear
right.
Soon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I think we're all in agreement about that. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
What do you call TC?
Sorry?
What quantity actually do you call TC?
So here the way we determine TC is we calculate the superfluid density in a finite system. So we find that it's finite everywhere. We track it as a function of temperature, and we ask when does it reach the Kosciuszko Tauless value? So if pi t over two t over pi.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so right, so how much time do I have?
Sorry, maybe like 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, okay, so let me just flash a different topic and right, finish there. Okay, so I want to switch gears. Another recent work, which is inspired by these Moray systems, okay, but very, very different flavor, also on superconductivity. And this work was done with Allen with Mark. Okay, so just as a background, okay, so one of the sort of long-term dreams in solid-state physics is to find a solid-state analog to the physics of helium-3, as we know, which is very, very rich, and in particular that exhibits many triplet superfluid phases. Okay, so as we know, there are not very many triplet superconductors found in nature. That turns out to be extremely challenging to find them, and even some of the ones that we thought are triplet turned out to be something else. Okay, and some of the requirements that are needed to find a triplet superconductor are listed here. Okay, so what we believe is that we need to have a strong electronic correlation, so a weakly correlated system, if it's superconductor, it would tend to be an S-wave superconductor. Okay, we want to have a nearby ferromagnetic fluctuations help. That is the case in helium-3, and the system needs to be very, very clean. Okay, because a disorder in a triplet superconductor would be a pair breaker, so this maybe explains part of the reason why these systems are so rare in solid state. Okay, but it's kind of interesting to point out that these Moray systems, like twisted bilayer graphene and its relatives, sort of naturally have all these ingredients in them. Okay, so the fact that there are strong electronic correlations is definitely there. There are nearby ferromagnetic states. Okay, so that's pretty well established in various systems like twisted bilayer graphene, twisted double bilayer graphene. Okay, this is actually a recent measurement from Shachar Ilani's group. This is a thermodynamic measurement of the magnetization, or more precisely, it is the derivative of the magnetization as a function of density. Okay, and it actually has this big peak at low field. It has this big peak near filling factor equals one. So the state at larger filling factors seems to be a ferromagnet. Okay, and these systems are sort of naturally very clean. Okay, so it looks like this might be a promising place to look, at least for a triplet superconductor. Okay, and moreover, unlike many solid state systems, these systems naturally have a very, very weak spin orbit coupling. If you have a ferromagnet at zero field, the direction of the magnetic moment is sort of free to rotate and to twist around, and it might intertwine in an interesting way with a superconductivity. That's what we're going to be after. Okay, and specifically, we were inspired by this experiment done at Harvard by Philip Kim's group. This is an experiment on a twisted double bilayer graphene. Okay, so it's two bilayers, two Bernal bilayer, non-twisted of a graphene, which have a relative twist angle to each other. Okay, and it turns out that for a given twist angle, you can apply a perpendicular electric field and control the bandwidth of these bands, and you can make these bands extremely flat. For a certain range of perpendicular electric field. Okay, so similar to twisted bilayer graphene, the system exhibits a correlated insulating states near integer fillings of the resulting Moray in itself. And in particular, it looks like near half filling, the system has a pretty clear insulator whose gap increases linearly with a parallel field. Okay, so this is it was taken as an indication of the spin ferromagnet. Okay, so it's magnetized. So if you apply an in-plane field, you can increase the gap as a function of field. And most strikingly, there's a sharp onset of a resistivity drop at low temperature near this insulator. So you basically change the carrier density close to a half filling, and you find a very rapid drop in the resistivity that looks like superconductivity. It's suppressed by perpendicular field. Okay, but as a function of in-plane field, so this this white curve, this is temperature, this is in-plane magnetic field. This white curve is the place where the resistivity drops to half of its normal state value before the drop. Okay, so this is some indication of TC. Okay, and you see that actually at very low field, T onset first actually increases linearly and then reaches the maximum and starts dropping. Okay, so this is very unusual. If you interpret this as onset of some kind of superconductivity, it means that TC actually increases linearly with field, and it's symmetric, so there would be a cusp. Okay, this they actually identify as a cusp-less tauless transition. So there's actually a cusp in TKT at zero field. Okay, so taken at face value, this would be a very strong indication for a triplet superconductor. Okay, so now this data is still debated. Okay, there are non-superconducting interpretations for this result. So I think the verdict is still on what exactly is going on in this system. Okay, but we took this as our inspiration. I think there are more ongoing experiments to figure out exactly what's going on here. And we'd like to ask, suppose we have a triplet superconductor in one of these Moret systems with a very weak spin orbit coupling, what would be the consequences? Okay, so there's a particular state we want to focus on. There are different kinds of triplet superconductors that are possible, but we'd like to focus on this particular type of triplet superconducting state, which is a fully spin polarized a triplet superconductor. Okay, so let me just remind you briefly how you parameterize the order parameter of a triplet superconductor. So you work with this object called the D vector, which is the anomalous excitation value, C dagger, of a triplet Cooper pair. And the D parameterizes the direction of the spin of the Cooper pair. Okay, so it's a complex three-dimensional vector. So it has a real and an imaginary parts. Okay, and you can parameterize different triplet superconducting states according to the relative magnitude and direction of the real and the imaginary parts of this D vector. Okay, and we're gonna focus on a particular case where basically only electrons of one spin component along some direction are paired. Okay, so that's a fully spin polarized superconductor. Okay, so there's some quantization axis, call that Z, and only up electrons along that quantization axis are paired. Say we're near a ferromagnet, so we're in the normal state is actually half metal. That would be an example. Okay, so there are only spin up electrons available at the Fermi energy, and only they can pair. In terms of this D vector, it turns out that that's captured by this configuration of the D vector, where D1 and D2 are equal in magnitude and perpendicular in direction. Okay, so, and then the D1 and D2, if there's no spin orbit coupling, can point anywhere in spin space. Okay, now the order parameter manifold is actually SO3, it's an orthogonal matrix, and the cross product of D1 and D2 is actually the direction of magnetization. That's the spin of the Cooper pair. Okay, so if the spin is pointing in the z-axis, D1 and D2 would point in the xy plane. And if you do a gauge transformation, you multiply the D vector, the complex D vector by a phase, that would not change, of course, the direction of quantization, but it would rotate D1 and D2 around this quantization axis. Okay, now, of course, strictly speaking, if you have this type of order parameter and no spin orbit coupling at all, however weak, there would be no finite temperature transition at all in 2D. Okay, so there would be a very long correlation length at low temperature, but strictly speaking, TC would be zero. Okay, so That's of course a general fact, but at low enough temperature for a finite system, since the correlation length would be very long, it would be very easily it would very easily exceed the system size. So we're going to ignore this fact, treat a finite system essentially as being ordered. Okay, and now there's an interesting consequence of this structure of the order parameter. So basically, the order parameter is a triad. Okay, to specify the order parameter, you need to specify a frame, which is formed by D1, D2, and their cross product, D1 cross D2. So it's an SO3 matrix. And this type of order parameter manifold has an interesting topological property. Okay, so you ask, what topological defects does this type of order parameter support? And we know, for instance, that in a regular superconductor, where the order parameter manifold is a regular complex phase, if you go around a closed loop, the phase of the superconductor can wind any integer number of times. So pi1 of u1 is equal to z. That number of windings is simply the vorticity trapped in this closed loop. Okay, so that's why integers, vortices in a superconductor are characterized by an integer vorticity. Here, it turns out that for this type of order parameter, if you go along a closed loop, pi1 of SO3 is actually z2. Okay, so you can have no vortex or a single vortex, but two vortices in this type of superconductor are actually equivalent to a trivial configuration. Okay, so two vortices, either plus or minus, there's no notion of plus or minus, two vortices can always annihilate each other. Okay, so this is a mathematical fact, okay, that pi1 of SO3 is equal to z2. If you're not familiar with it, there's sort of a nice geometrical way that we just very briefly mentioned, okay, for those who have not seen it. Okay, you can parameterize an SO3 matrix or a SO3 transformation by a point inside a solid ball. Okay, so basically think about the direction of the point as the rotation axis and the radius as the rotation angle. Okay, so each point in this ball is a distinct SO3 matrix, but you need to identify rotations by basically plus and minus pi, or pi around this axis and minus pi around that axis. That's actually the same rotation. Okay, so it's a ball where on the surface of this ball and with radius pi, antipodal points are actually identified. Okay, and from that you can see that the topology of the closed loop is actually Z2. Okay, so if you have this closed loop that goes from the south pole to the north pole, that's like a vortex with a plus vorticity, if you like. But of course, you can continuously rotate this trajectory and turn a plus vortex into a minus vortex.
Okay, so that's a quick check. I get it right. The same thing as what you have in uniaxial pneumatics, projective
planes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Right. Yes, so it's the same kind of Z2 defect that you have there. Yeah, this was pointed out in the helium-3 literature in the context of triplet superconductors. Okay, so so now what are the consequences in the terms of superconductivity? So let me go through that briefly. Okay, so suppose we're inside the fully polarized triplet superconducting phase. So here's our complex D vector, and we can write basically the free energy related to slow spatial variations of this order parameter. And it turns out that there are two terms that are allowed by symmetry. One of them is kappa D, just the gradient of D itself. And the other one is kappa m, that's gradients of d star cross d. This is the magnetization direction, basically, of the spin polarization of the Cooper pairs. Okay, so this kappa m term, if you like, is an excess stiffness of the spin direction. Okay, so it's convenient to represent this order parameter, but instead of as a complex vector, as a 2x2 unitary matrix. Okay, so that's the way to do it, and you can represent either spin rotations or gauge transformations on this 2x2 unitary matrix. Okay, and in particular, a state that has a superconducting phase twist would correspond to this unitary matrix, okay, that depends on X in a periodic way. This is a state that carries a finite supercurrent. Okay, so now the fact that the order parameter topology is Z2 on a closed loop means that if we start from this type of configuration that has two phase windings, so the phase winds as a function of space and it has a winding of 4π, you can actually unwind the superconducting phase by forming a spin texture. Okay, so that's basically the context of this statement, and Eyal came up with this nice interpolation of the trajectory. Okay, so this is a function of x and tau. X is real space. Tau is a path parameter. For tau equals zero, this configuration of the unitary matrix has a phase twist of 4π. And for tau equals one, you've actually unwound this phase twist completely. And on the way, what you have is you formed a spin texture. Okay, so this is what the order parameter does. This is this axis is x position, and this axis is tau, the path parameter. Okay, so you start from this configuration where the green arrow is the magnetization. So the magnetization is constant in space. And the red and the blue are the D1 and D2. When they rotate, it means that the superconducting phase twists. Okay, so this initial configuration is a configuration where the superconducting phase twists by 4π. It carries a current in the x direction. Okay, and you can undergo this process where you unwind the superconducting phase twist. Okay, by introducing a spin texture and then unwinding. Okay, so what this trajectory does is it interpolates smoothly between two phase windings and zero. And you see that in this particular trajectory, you actually flip the direction of the spin on the way. Okay, so to actually do this dynamically, you need some mechanism to change the spin system. So this cannot happen if the system is completely isolated and if the total magnetization of the system is perfectly conserved. Then even though this trajectory is possible, it would not actually happen dynamically. But if there's some coupling to some kind of spin bath, this can actually happen. Okay, so what this implies is that there's a new type of mechanism to relax spin in this type of system. And let me just discuss a couple of consequences of this that we thought about. Okay, so it can allow to maybe even identify this kind of superconductor. Okay, so this is the free energy landscape of this type of unwinding procedure, okay, or unwinding process. So it turns out that even though you can smoothly unwind a 4π phase twist, you might still have a free energy barrier to do that. And that's because this process actually involves creating this spin texture. And if the spin stiffness is too high, then as a function of this path parameter tau, the free energy would first have to increase and then decrease when you unwind the phase twist. Okay, but there's a critical value of the rate of phase twist, which corresponds to a critical current, beyond which there's no free energy barrier anymore. So you can just decrease the free energy immediately, starting from some configuration that has a finite phase twist. Okay, and there's a critical current that corresponds to the current in which this energy barrier, free energy barrier, goes to zero. Okay, in which you can actually unwind a phase twist with no a free energy barrier, and this critical current density. It depends inversely on the system size. That's because it's a finite number of phase windings. So it's a mesoscopic critical current density where there's no free energy barrier for this type of decay process. Now, what happens when you exceed this critical current? Well, the phase will just smoothly decay by two windings. So for instance, think about this type of setup. Suppose that we have a strip of a triplet superconductor. We attach two leads to it and apply a small voltage. Okay, so what would happen is that the phase would start twisting linearly with time. Okay, so that means that the current would increase linearly in time, just like as usual is when you apply a constant voltage across a superconductor. So this is the current as a function of time. The current would increase, exceed this critical current. And once it does, it can actually, with no energy barrier, okay, so this can happen even at very low temperature, as long as there's some mechanism to relax the spin, with no energy barrier, it can actually relax a phase twist that corresponds to 4 pi. Okay, so some current is relaxed, and then it's below the critical current density, and it starts growing again. Okay, so what this would result in is these periodic oscillations of the current at the constant voltage. So this is analogous to the AC Josephson effect, but the unusual thing is that the periodicity of this Josephson effect is actually, the period is actually doubled the usual period, because each one of these sawtooths actually occurs when the phase twist across the entire system increases by 4 pi. That's a direct manifestation of the Z2 topology of the order parameter. So what you get here is actually a Josephson frequency, which is half of the usual Josephson frequency. Okay, so this is our prediction. We've done some Langevin simulations of a model that I won't describe. Okay, but that shows it. The current at the fixed voltage, the current increases linearly. It can actually overshoot this critical current because of dynamical effects depending on parameters. But you do get the periodicity that you expect according to this formula. Okay, and this model also has a prediction on the dependence of the average current on the voltage that you apply. Okay, but I won't go into that. Now, I'll just mention very, very briefly, when you apply a Zeeman field, of course, you pin the direction of the magnetization, so you increase the barrier to this kind of process. And as a result, you actually increase the critical current. So there's another prediction of this model that I won't go in detail into, but this critical current would actually increase at first, like the square root of B. Okay, so that's another prediction that you can make. Okay, so so let me just conclude. Okay, so these are some possible interesting aspects of the physics of these new array systems. Okay, so I discussed what happens to TC in the limits of a perfectly flat band. I think this still is the question, what's the optimal optimal parameters for superconductivity in this kind of case? It looks like as long as you increase U, you can get to higher TC. And I discussed the possibility of a fully spin polarized triplet superconductor and the new possibilities by the topology of the order parameter in that case. Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much for a very interesting talk. We asked a lot of questions, but if there is any other questions, then we can take them now, especially for the second part. Is there any other question? But I have a quick question. So I understand that you tried to get some spin polarized superconductor, but was there any other motivation to think about this particular choice?
You mean as opposed to other type of triplet, for instance?
Right, that was my question.
Yeah. There were a couple, I guess, a couple of reasons to think about this particular type of order parameter. The first is that if you think about the natural case in twisted double layer graphene, presumably when you're at half filling, then it's a fully spin polarized ferromagnetic insulator. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now if you get superconductivity nearby, you dope that system a little bit, and suppose that it remains a ferromagnet. So it's kind of natural that the normal state there would be a half metal. So then if that goes superconducting, this would be the natural state. That was the reasoning. There's no direct evidence either way. Okay, there's another sort of very general argument that if the normal state is a ferromagnet, then by Ginzburg-Landau type arguments, the first state that you would go into is a fully spin polarized. If you get this, a triplet superconductor, the first state you would go into is a fully spin polarized superconductor, because only one spin component would condense first. Okay, basically the spin component, which is favored by the magnetism of the normal state. At lower temperature, you might go into another, a more complicated triplet superconducting state that breaks an additional symmetry. Okay, but at least not too far from TC, this is the natural state.
Mm-hmm. In this second part, you didn't use these non-localizable Wannier functions, etc., right?
No, this was all based on symmetry considerations. Yeah. This doesn't depend on you.
Why should we not? I mean, what's the difference from, say, liquid helium 3, which you can spin polarize?
Yes, right.
Some of these effects that you are talking about.
Right. So as far as I know,
just some effects in helium 3. I don't know that it's been done on a spin polarized helium 3, but there's
been it's a good question. As far as I know, in helium 3, none of the phases at zero field are spin polarized. You can get, this is one of the phases of helium 3 when you apply a magnetic field. But if you apply a too big magnetic field, these effects also get washed away, because you just pin the direction of the magnetization. So these effects rely on being able to form some kind of spin texture. And that's hard to do if you have a large Zeeman energy. So that's why I'm not sure that helium 3 is the best platform, but is this
defect that you talked about related to this vortex without a core of Toulouse and Anderson?
I think there's
evidence for that also experimentally, not very definitive, but there is.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So. I think similar things indeed would happen here. Yeah. If you have vortices, you can have vortices with no cores that involve some kind of spin texture.
Yes, I have actually a bit of a stupid question, just revealing that this is not very familiar territory. I get it right that when you look at your magnetization, your M factor, that's coupling to an external magnetic field, right? Is that correct? So what happens when you apply a magnetic field? My good feeling was
what happens gradually is that these effects go away. You just pin the direction of the magnetization, and then the order parameter space sort of goes down back to basically U1. You know, the only degree of freedom that remains is the phase of the superconducting order parameter. So it becomes harder and harder to do this unwinding process. So what happens is that when you apply a Zeeman field, you increase the barrier, the energy barrier for this type of process. For a small field, it can still happen. It will just require a larger current. So the critical current increases with magnetic field until that reaches some microscopic critical current, and then it becomes like an ordinary superconductor.
That's related, right? So you need a spin heat pass for this, right? You have to dump your magnetization.
Yes, yes.
How should we imagine that? Like a system of nuclear spins would be good enough?
Yeah, so we believe that's something we're still thinking through, what can serve as a spin bath. We believe that in these mesoscopic systems, you know, a system of a few microns across, the leads can actually serve as the spin bath. That's probably the most effective spin bath that can give you reasonable time scales for dissipating spins. Okay, in these graphene systems, that seems to be the best candidate. I don't think there are enough, unless you somehow introduce them on purpose, there are not enough nuclear spins or spin impurities of any kind.
So to think about it, generally, it's basically like that you have a total magnetization, that's a conserved quantity when you're in isolation, so your M factor takes that well, and then you need something where you can dump the...
You can dissipate magnetization.
Dissipate.
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, RS. Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
So you said that for unwinding of the vortex, you need some spin bath. So by that, do you mean that there's no path that conserves the total spin?
We have not been able to find any. It's an excellent question. We tried a little bit. Maybe it's just the limitation of our imagination. So, I mean, one thing is clear, right? If you start from a fully spolarized configuration, then definitely there's no path, right? Because you start fully polarized. So there's sort of nothing you can do with a spin degree of freedom without changing the total magnetization.
That's right.
Okay, so that's pretty clear. But if you start from some configuration that doesn't have a full polarization, then it becomes less clear. Okay, suppose you...
Just clarification. So the thermodynamic ground state is fully polarized, I presume. It's like
the ground state is fully polarized, but we tried to imagine things like suppose we couple to two ferromagnets. The leads are ferromagnetic, and they actually have an opposite magnetization. So now the ground state would have a spiral of the spin, such that the total magnetization in the ground state is actually zero. Okay, then it's less obvious that you can't, even while conserving the total spin, that you can't somehow do a similar process. But we couldn't find any.
When this would be an icing magnet, there would be a domain wall. And because you have this funky order parameter, right, it's basically forming kind of a spiral, kind of this block wall or something.
Beginning the spiral from the edges, right?
Okay, so thank you very much. I'd like to thank NH for a great talk, and also to all the participants for active discussion. So I think we can close the talk today, and we'll see you next week. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Iris.
Thank you.